Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
When you're driving through a community that has sidewalks on both sides, many times it is legal for pedestrians to cross, and drivers need to be very aware of that.
Anchorage officials consider what to do after a record-tying number of pedestrian deaths. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Monday, September 30th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, a woman's death has Bethel residents searching for answers.
Last time I talked with Naomi was a few days before they found her. This is what she said, "Babe, you should come get me, I'm scared."
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly. An Anchorage police officer shot and killed a man last night after police say the man ran at the officer while armed with a knife. The man, who has not yet been named, is the 5th person shot and killed by Anchorage police this year. That's the most fatal police shootings in a year in at least the past quarter century. According to the Anchorage Police Department, the man had called 911 multiple times yesterday. He reported an emergency with someone injured on North Park Street. Police were dispatched to the scene around 7 p.m. The first officer to arrive was in his car awaiting backup when the man approached, according to Police Chief Sean Case. At a news conference on the shooting, Case said the officer stepped out of his vehicle and ordered the man to drop the knife.
The officer got out of his car, immediately started backpedaling to create distance, to create time where he could continue to provide commands and communicate. And the subject started running with the officer. And the officer began to increase his speed at which he was backpedaling.
The officer ultimately shot the man once in the chest. Medics took the man to a local hospital where he was pronounced dead. Police say the man's knife had a roughly foot-long blade, and they say officers were not initially aware that he was the same person who had called 911. Case said the call is one of many difficult incidents officers respond to.
This puts officers in a challenging situation. I can't highlight enough how important it is that people respond to commands that officers give so these types of tragedies don't occur.
The man killed Sunday is the 8th person police have shot this year during a response, wounding 3 of them and killing 5. And the Anchorage Police Department is delaying the release of the body camera footage of officers shooting and killing 16-year-old Easter Liafa last month. In a statement on Friday, police officials said that the request for the delay came from the State Office of Special Prosecutions, which is currently reviewing the shooting to determine if criminal charges against officers involved in the shooting are warranted. According to the police statement, the state sent a letter to Chief Sean Case saying the delay, quote, safeguards the integrity of its active criminal investigation and protects the constitutional rights of the accused, end quote. Under the police department's body camera policy, footage of critical incidents like police shootings is supposed to be released to the public within 45 days, but the chief can delay the release for a number of reasons. Friday marked 45 days since the fatal shooting. Anchorage police on Friday referred requests for additional information to the state, which did not immediately respond. Liafa was killed by police on August 13th after officers responded to a domestic dispute at her home. Liafa's sister had called 911, saying she was threatening others with a knife. Her family has said they never expected police to respond and shoot Liafa, and her death has drawn widespread community outrage. Thirteen pedestrians have been killed by cars so far in Anchorage this year, tying a grim record and renewing calls from the community to make city roads safer. As Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early reports, state and city leaders say some improvements can happen quickly, while others will take a lot more time.
Anna Boson is Central Region Traffic and Safety Engineer for Alaska's Department of Transportation, and she says there isn't one single thing driving this year's high number of pedestrian fatalities in Anchorage.
Aggressive driving was a contributing factor. Driving under the influence was a contributing factor in many of these crashes. Driving without headlights on. Driving with tinted windows. So there are many contributing factors in this beyond the pedestrians' actions.
Six people were killed by cars in Anchorage in September alone, the highest number in a single month in more than a decade. The rise in pedestrian fatalities is a problem not just here, but nationwide, and it's one that engineers and other experts are trying to solve. But they say major solutions will take time, money, and community buy-in. In Anchorage, assembly leaders want speed limits lowered on some roads and more lighting installed. Most of the pedestrians killed this year were crossing the street outside of a crosswalk, in the dark, and on roadways where the speed limit was 45 miles per hour or higher. Assembly leaders also asked for more traffic enforcement and for a public campaign for pedestrian safety. Boson says the funding for these projects comes from the Federal Highway Safety Improvement Plan, where the state gets money from the federal government and then chooses projects to fund. She says many areas that have seen pedestrian deaths are on the state's radar.
Many of these sites were already on our list of considering nominations for them. So we have already created scope. We have already created budgets and recommendations.
She says some projects will also rely on an increase in public awareness. She worries that simply adding infrastructure, like crosswalks, won't be enough.
It's a nuance that I think many drivers aren't aware of. And so when you're driving through a community that has sidewalks on both sides, many times it is legal for pedestrians to cross, and drivers need to be very aware of that.
In the short term, there's an ongoing legal question about whether the city can change speed limits on state roads, which are the site of a majority of this year's deaths. Brad Coy, Anchorage's traffic engineer, says he believes he has the authority, but he'd still want the state to be involved.
We would want to do it in conjunction and partnership and, coordination with the state, given that it's on their roads, they maintain the signs on their roads, and if they have the power and we have the power and we do something different than what they do, it just becomes messy.
And while Anchorage pedestrian deaths are on the rise, it's not the only city facing this problem.
We are in the midst of a pedestrian safety crisis in the U.S.
That's Ravina John with Smart Growth America, a national nonprofit that works with communities to improve transportation and land use infrastructure.
We are at a 40-year high in terms of pedestrian fatalities. There's been a 75% increase of the number of people who've been killed while walking on the roads since 2010.
She attributes the rise to a focus from traffic planners on getting drivers from point A to point B faster, and a focus from car manufacturers to make larger vehicles as opposed to the smaller sedans of the past.
We've designed so many places in the U.S. to be really sprawling, with wide straight roads focused on, you know, trying to eliminate congestion, but what you're really doing is encouraging drivers to drive fast.
John says the suggestions made by advocates and assembly members are good ones, especially lowering speed limits and adding more lighting. She says cities that have been successful in reducing pedestrian deaths have also worked to redesign how their roads look.
If we want people to slow down, we should narrow the lanes. We should install more crosswalks with more signals. There are design improvements that don't require an officer's oversight, or people to, make the right choice in terms of following the speed limit.
Coy, the city engineer, says that Anchorage officials are already working to make the city more pedestrian friendly, like the bike lane pilot project this summer.
It was a phenomenal opportunity to try a new facility and see how it was going to get used and what some of the challenges and benefits were, and working with the state as a key partner. So doing more pilots, I could see being a super helpful way to figure some of this out.
Boson with the state says it's all part of a collaborative process between the state and the city called Vision Zero. The idea is that all pedestrian deaths are preventable, and the goal is having none. She says nominations for projects are due at the start of October.
The soonest we could start pulling the trigger on those, on funding those solutions, is after the new year.
State and city traffic leaders are due to provide their findings to the assembly at its next regular meeting. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Wesley Early.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a fencing club keeps Kenai residents active in the winter months.
Everybody wants to play with the sword. But really, 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 it's about doing the boring drills with your feet and everything else.
That's ahead. Stay with us. An apartment fire in Ketchikan Sunday morning left one person dead and another critically injured. The apartment complex is located on 2nd Avenue near the August 25th landslide zone. Ketchikan Fire Chief Rick Hines says the neighbors in the apartment upstairs from the fire noticed smoke and called for help at about 8:30 a.m. Firefighters arrived on scene within 2 minutes of being dispatched. Hines says they found light smoke coming out of the building and a small indoor fire that was easily extinguished. Crews transported the two victims inside, a 34-year-old woman and a 63-year-old man, to Peace Health Medical Center, where the woman was pronounced dead. The man was medevaced to the Alaska Native Medical Center in Anchorage, where he is in critical but improving condition. An initial investigation found that the fire started in the bathroom, then burned through the door to the attached bedroom. Hines says both victims, who were a couple, were harmed not by the flames, but by inhaling the smoke.
Most, when I generalize fire victims across the United States, it is from smoke inhalation. A fire produces toxic smoke. It is going to be filled with cyanide, going to be filled with carbon monoxide and heat.
According to authorities, the home had smoke detectors present, but they had been dismantled. Hines says these days it's even more important for residents to have working smoke detectors than it used to be because modern materials burn hotter and produce smoke more quickly.
These things happen very, very, very rapidly in the modern home. So most everything in our homes nowadays is made of plastic. So basically, gasoline derivatives, if you will.
Three upstairs neighbors were evaluated and treated for smoke inhalation at the local hospital, then released. They and other residents of the building were evacuated due to smoke and water damage. Hines says his heart goes out to the evacuated residents who just recently got back into their homes after being evacuated for weeks after the slide. The death of a young woman in Bethel this summer has left family, friends, and advocates for missing and murdered Indigenous people demanding answers. KYUK's Evan Erickson has more, and a quick note, this story contains descriptions of death and physical violence that some listeners may find disturbing.
Little is known about what happened in the hours leading up to the death of 29-year-old Naomi Larson, who was found alone in a Bethel home on August 5th, face down in a hallway with a blanket covering the upper half of her body, according to police. The Bethel Police Department says there is no immediate indication of foul play, but friends and family members say they believe there's more to the story. Larson's family held a funeral in mid-August in her home village of Nunapichuk. Her mother, Sophia Larson, says her daughter's face had signs of physical trauma.
When her body arrived, she looked visibly beaten because her face was swollen and her eyes were slightly open. She had some kind of stabbing on her forehead. There was visibly a cut, like an X mark or something.
But according to an email from Bethel Police, Larson's body showed, quote, no sign of trauma of any kind when she was discovered at a home she was staying at in Bethel's housing subdivision. According to the police report, officers responded to the home after receiving a 911 call requesting a welfare check. Officers that arrived just before 2 in the afternoon on August 5th found the front door locked, but were let in by a property manager. The police report says nothing about an estimated time of death, but the Bethel Police Department said by email that rigor mortis was not present and that all indications show Larson had been deceased for a, quote, short amount of time. The police report says that a man arrived at the house while officers were still on scene. The man told officers he had known Larson for around a month and had been with her the previous night. According to the report, he told officers he called a cab to go to his job around 9 a.m. that morning and that Larson locked the door behind him when he left. The report does not say at what time the man returned to the residence or whether he was questioned by police about the circumstances of Larson's death, including the blanket found over the upper half of her body. According to the report, the woman who initially called 911 told officers she had made 3 separate visits to the house on August 5th, believing her lost cell phone might be inside. She told officers she called 911 after Larson did not respond to her attempts to wake her up. She said she had last seen Larson 3 to 4 days earlier and that she knew of 3 people who had been at the house several days before Larson's death. Larson's close friend, Trisha White, who says she was in an on-and-off relationship with Larson at the time of her death, says she believes there were more people coming and going from the house.
The last time I talked with Naomi was a few days before they found her. This is what she said, babe, you should come get me, I'm scared. And there's lots of drunk people.
people in the background, and I can mostly hear men. Before I even asked her what the address was, somebody grabbed the phone and hung up.
White says she believes that call came from the residence where Larson's body was found. White also attended Larson's funeral in New Napichuk and echoed Larson's mother's concerns about her physical condition.
Those bruises and the cut on her forehead and her eyes being red and her neck being swollen, she didn't look like that the days before they found her.
The police report does not say whether officers questioned any of the neighbors at the time about what they may have seen prior to the discovery of Larson's body. White herself says as of September 26th, police had not reached out to her for more information, despite multiple attempts to share what she knows. According to the police report, both the woman who called 911 and the man interviewed at the scene agreed to come to the police station to be interviewed more thoroughly, but only a statement taken from the woman at the police station is included in the police report. The Bethel Police Department declined to comment on whether the man's statement is absent from the report because he invoked his Miranda right to remain silent. Prior to interviewing the man and woman at the police station, BPD officers searched the residence where Larson's body was found and seized several items as evidence, including a, quote, small blue pill appearing to be made from home. The report says the pill was sent to a crime lab for analysis. Autopsy results from the state medical examiner are expected to be released in the coming weeks. Sophia Larson, Naomi Larson's mother, says it has been painful to wonder what happened to her daughter and to see so much speculation on social media.
I feel like we need closure for this to help us move on.
On September 19th, the Bethel Police Department wrote in an email that the department will determine whether the investigation is complete depending on the findings of the autopsy. With reporting from KYUK's Sage Smiley in Bethel, I'm Evan Erickson.
Matanuska Susitna Borough voters will see two subtle but significant changes on local ballots in November due to updates to election laws made by the Borough Assembly earlier this year. The Matsu Sentinel reports that beginning this year, candidates elected to full terms as mayor or to the Borough Assembly will serve 4 years, up from three. And candidates for mayor, assembly, and school board can appear on the ballot with a political party affiliation, a first for local governments in the state. The Assembly approved the updates earlier this year. They were sponsored by Assembly member Rob Yunt, who has since resigned. While officials briefly considered seeking voter approval for the changes, the Assembly ultimately voted to proceed without it. Under the change, new borough mayors or Assembly members elected for the first time in November and beyond can serve up to 8 years total or 2 4-year terms. The rule does not extend to current terms of Assembly members or the mayor. While extending term limits is intended to increase voter turnout, adding partisan labels is meant to improve voter information, Assembly members said earlier this year. By law, all borough elections are nonpartisan, but officials said that rule refers to whether the borough holds closed primaries, not whether candidates can identify a political party. Some Assembly members said that adding party information to ballots will help voters understand candidates' platforms. A borough-produced election brochure set to be mailed to registered voters does not highlight or provide information about either change. A totem pole was raised at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center in Juneau over the weekend. Though it's new to the center, the porcupine and beaver Kutia is almost 40 years old. It was carved by late master lingot carver Amos Wallace. For decades, it lived inside the U.S. Forest Service office in Juneau, but on Saturday, it was rededicated to its new home inside the visitor center. Amos's son, Brian Wallace, was at the ceremony on Saturday. He says it means a lot to him to know that his father's work will now live where thousands, perhaps millions, of visitors will see it.
It's kind of a homecoming right now. So now tens of thousands of people who visit the Glacier Center are going to be able to visit it. And it's not going to fade away. You know, it's going to have an indefinite lifetime.
The pole was raised just before Orange Shirt Day on Monday. It's an international day recognizing the effects of boarding schools on Indigenous communities. Amos was one of many Alaska Native children removed from their families and forcibly assimilated at government or church-run institutions. The practice lasted from the 1800s through the 1970s. Wallace says the trauma from that experience deeply impacted his father, who found healing through his art. Wallace says he hopes it can do the same for the people who will look at the totem pole in the years to come.
And have a great pride that, you know, my dad did his part to keep the artwork going, even though it was oppressed. It just shows the world that the Tlingit, Haida, Tsimshian, you know, they had a rich heritage, but they are still vibrant. We're still here. Despite everything that happened, there's still artwork here.
The pole also signifies another step toward tribal sovereignty, according to the Central Council of the Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska. The tribe helped make the move possible and hosted the rededication ceremony. A year ago, the tribe and the U.S. Forest Service signed a memorandum of agreement to co-manage the Mendenhall Glacier Recreation Area together to better educate visitors on the indigenous history of the area. The tribe hired 10 tribal members this summer to work as ambassadors at the visitor center, sharing their personal connections to Tlingit culture and how Tlingit people are connected to the land. Well, many Alaskans believe the key to thriving in the winter months is staying physically active, and for some on the Kenai Peninsula, that means dueling with long pointed blades. As KDLL's Hunter Morrison reports, the region's longtime fencing club recently moved to a larger practice space, which they hope will attract more members.
Advance, lunge, parry, repose. One more time. Only when I call. Advance, lunge, parry, repose.
On a recent Tuesday, in the cafeteria of Kenai Central High School, assistant fencing coach Travis Lawson leads a group of about half a dozen, mostly youth, through a series of stretches and footwork. It's one of the Kenai Peninsula Fencing Club's first meetups of the season after a summer hiatus.
Whenever we see that sword coming towards us, we want to instinctively parry. I want to make sure that we're parrying in the right way.
The group is donned in mesh masks and are holding foils, long and pointed blades that look like a sword. It's one of three blade types the Kenai-based group will learn how to use. The fencing club formed about 35 years ago in Homer. It eventually expanded to a second chapter on the peninsula after club member Peter Gundunas moved to Soldotna for a teaching job 15 years ago. He's been the head coach ever since. Gundunas says the Central Peninsula's chapter is now the only active chapter on the Kenai.
Our rules are very refined, and in reality, we're playing tag. You know, I mean, it's not like we're ha-ha-ha, you know, we're really, we come from the martial arts, we come from the art of defense, but we've taken it to such a level of athletics and speed that it's completely different. The safety gear is phenomenal.
Gundunas says people, mostly beginners, join the club for a number of reasons. Some like the low-impact exercises associated with fencing, which Gundunas says is a way to stay fit in the winter. But for many, a big part of the appeal is the swords.
Everybody wants to play with the sword, but really, 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 it's about doing the boring drills with your feet and everything else. And as my master said, he goes, this is a two-lifetime sport. You can't master it in one lifetime. It takes two lifetimes.
Early in the season, the group learns how to advance and step away from an opponent. The later get accustomed to fencing attire and practice the eight ways to block a blade by hand. The club also teaches respect for your opponent, an important part of fencing etiquette. The club currently has less than 10 active members, many of which are homeschoolers. Leif Abel of Kasilof is one of the only adults in the club. His two young children, who also fence, convinced him to take a stab at it last year after they fell in love with the sport. Abel says it's a win-win to exercise in a group setting while spending time with his children. The swords, he says, are an added bonus.
I mean, it's one thing to bring your kids to a sport and drop them off or even stay and watch. I mean, that's very rewarding to watch your kids do something they enjoy physically. But to do it with them is a lot of fun. Gives you a lot more insights for sure. Like, I mean, I can see them trying to pick it up while I'm trying to pick it up.
Abel says another part of fencing's appeal is the fast-paced problem-solving associated with it. Gundunas calls the sport kinetic chess.
All the way out. So find one, slowly advance, lunge, try to hit that point. If you miss it, reset, try it again. Once you hit it multiple times in a row, find a new one.
The club also competes in tournaments against other Alaska fencing groups and have several wins under their belt. A few high school students have even received full-ride fencing scholarships and have gone on to coach fencing themselves. But even if you're just in it for the swords, Gundunas says the group's camaraderie is unmatched.
My attitude is the only people who lose are the ones that don't show up. You show up, win, lose, or draw, it doesn't matter. You came to fence. Let's fence.
All right. So, partner up, we got 2-2, looks like.
The club recently moved their practice location to Kenai Central High School's cafeteria. They say this new space is more accommodating to the smaller church they moved from. To learn more about the club, be sure to check out their website, Facebook, and YouTube channel. In Kenai, I'm Hunter Morrison.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Chris Clinton, Wesley Early in Anchorage, Michael Finelli in Ketchikan, Evan Erickson in Bethel, Clarice Larson in Juneau, and Hunter Morrison in Kenai. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky's our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.